This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Darth Plagueis, by James Luceno. Read for you by Daniel Davis. Prologue. A tremor took hold of the planet. Sprung from death, it unleashed itself in a powerful wave, at once burrowing deep into the world's core and radiating through its saccharine atmosphere to shake the stars themselves. At the quake's epicenter stood Sidious, one elegant hand vised on the burnished sill of an expansive translucency. A vessel filled suddenly to bursting, the force so strong within him that he feared he might disappear into it, never to return. But the moment didn't constitute an ending so much as a true beginning, long overdue. It was less a transformation than an intensification, a gravitic shift. A welter of voices, near and far, present and from eons past, drowned his thoughts. Raised in praise, the voices proclaimed his reign and cheered the inauguration of a new order. Yellow eyes lifted to the night sky, he saw the trembling stars flare, and in the depth of his being, he felt the power of the dark side anoint him. Slowly, almost reluctantly, he came back to himself, his gaze settling on his manicured hands. Returned to the present, he took note of his rapid breathing, while behind him, the room labored to restore order. Air scrubbers hummed, costly wall tapestries undulating in the summoned breeze. Prized carpets sealed their fibers against the spread of spilled fluids. The droid shuffled in obvious confliction. Sidious pivoted to take in the disarray. Antique furniture overturned, framed artwork askew, as if a whirlwind had swept through. And face down on the floor lay a statue of Yanjan, one of four law-giving sages of Dwarty, a piece Sidious had secretly coveted. Also sprawled there, Plagueis, his slender limbs splayed and elongated head turned to one side. Dressed in finery as for a night on the town. And now, dead. Or was he? Uncertainty rippled through Sidious, rage returning to his eyes. A tremor of his own making, or one of forewarning? Was it possible that the wily Mune had deceived him? Had Plagueis unlocked the key to immortality and survived after all? Never mind that it would constitute a petty move for one so wise, for one who had professed to place the grand plan above all else. Had Plagueis become ensnared in a self-spun web of jealousy and possessiveness, victim of his own engineering, his own foibles? If he hadn't been concerned for his own safety, Sidious might have pitied him. Wary of approaching the corpse of his former master, he called on the Force to roll the aged Mune over onto his back. From that angle, Plagueis looked almost as he had when Sidious first met him decades earlier. Smooth, hairless cranium, humped nose with its bridge flattened as if from a shock ball blow, and its sharp tip pressed almost to his upper lip, jutting lower jaw, sunken eyes still brimming with menace. A physical characteristic rarely encountered in a Mune. But then Plagueis had never been an ordinary Mune, nor an ordinary being of any sort. Sidious took care, still reaching out with a force. On closer inspection, he saw that Plagueis's already cyanotic flesh was smoothing out, his features relaxing. Faintly aware of the whir of air scrubbers and sounds of the outside world infiltrating the luxurious suite, he continued the vigil. Then, in relief, he pulled himself up to his full height and let out his breath. This was no Sith trick, not an instance of feigning death, but one of succumbing to its cold embrace. The being who had guided him to power was gone. Rai amusement narrowed his eyes. The Mune might have lived another 100 years unchanged. He might have lived forever had he succeeded fully in his quest. But in the end, though he could save others from death, he had failed to save himself. A sense of supreme accomplishment puffed Sidious's chest, and his thoughts unreeled.
Well, then, that wasn't nearly as bad as we thought it might be.
Rarely did events play out as imagined in any case. The order of future events was transient. In the same way that the past was reconfigured by selective memory, future events, too, were moving targets. One could only act on instinct, grab hold of an intuited perfect moment and spring into action. One heartbeat late, and the universe would have recomposed itself. No imposition of will sufficient to forestall the currents. One could only observe and react. Surprise was the element absent from any periodic table, a keystone element, a missing ingredient, the means by which the Force amused itself. A reminder to all sentient beings that some secrets could never be unlocked. Confident that the will of the dark side had been done, he returned to the suite's window wall. Two beings in a galaxy of countless trillions. But what had transpired in the suite would affect the lives of all of them. Already the galaxy had been shaped by the birth of one, and henceforth would be reshaped by the death of the other. But had the change been felt and recognized elsewhere? Were his sworn enemies aware that the Force had shifted irrevocably? Would it be enough to rouse them from self-righteousness? He hoped not, for now the work of vengeance could begin in earnest. His eyes sought and found an ascending constellation of stars, one of power and consequence new to the sky, though soon to be overwhelmed by dawn's first light. Low in the sky over the flatlands, visible only to those who knew where and how to look, it ushered in a bold future. To some, the stars and planets might seem to be moving as ever, destined to align in configurations calculated long before their fiery births. But in fact, the heavens had been perturbed, tugged by dark matter into novel alignments. In his mouth, Sidious tasted the tang of blood. In his chest, he felt the monster rising, emerging from shadowy depths and contorting his aspect into something fearsome just short of revealing itself to the world. The dark side had made him its property, and now he made the dark side his. Breathless, not from exertion, but from the sudden inspiration of power, he let go of the sill and allowed the monster to writhe through his body like an unbroken beast of range or prairie. Had the Force ever been so strong in anyone? Sidious had never learned how Plagueis' own master had met his end. Had he died at Plagueis' hand? Had Plagueis, too, experienced a similar exaltation on becoming a sole Sith Lord? Had the beast of the end time risen then to peek at the world it was to inhabit, knowing its release was imminent? He raised his gaze to the ecliptic. The answers were out there, coded in light, speeding through space and time, liquid fire coursing through him, visions of past and future riffling through his mind. He opened himself to the reconfigured galaxy, as if in an effort to peel away the decades. Part 1. Enlistment. 67 to 65 years before the Battle of Yavin. Chapter 1. The Underworld. 47 standard years before the harrowing reign of Emperor Palpatine, Baldemnik was nothing more than an embryonic world in the Outer Rim's Oryl sector, populated by reptilian sentients who expressed as little tolerance for outsiders as they did for one another. Decades later, the planet would have a part to play in galactic events, its own wink of historical notoriety. But in those formative years that presaged the Republic's ineluctable slide into decadence and turmoil, Baldemnik was of interest only to xenobiologists and cartographers. It might even have escaped the notice of Darth Plagueis, for whom remote worlds held a special allure, had his master Tenebris not discovered something special about the planet.
"Darth Bane would appreciate our efforts," the Sith Master was telling his apprentice as they stood side by side in the crystalline cave that had drawn them across the stars. A Bith, Tenebris was as tall as Plagueis, and nearly as cadaverously thin. To human eyes, his bilious complexion might have made him appear as haggard as the pallid Mune, but in fact both beings were in robust health. Though they conversed in basic, each was fluent in the other's native language.
"Darth Bane's early years," Plagueis said through his transpirator mask, "carrying on the ancestral business, as it were."
Behind the faceplate of his own mask, Tenebris's puckered lips twitched in disapproval. The breathing device looked absurdly small on his outsized cleft head, and the convexity of the mask made the flat discs of his lidless eyes look like close-set holes in his pinched face.
"Bane's seminal years."
Plagueis weathered the gentle rebuke. He had been apprenticed to Tenebris for as many years as the average human might live, and still Tenebris never failed to find fault when he could.
"What more appropriate way for us to close the circle than by mimicking the Sithari's seminal efforts? We weave ourselves into the warp and weft of the tapestry he created."
Plagueis kept his thoughts to himself. The aptly named Darth Bane, who had redefined the Sith by limiting their number and operating from concealment, had mined Cortosis as a youth on Apatros, long before embracing the tenets of the dark side. In the 1,000 years since his death, Bane had become deified, the powers attributed to him legendary. And indeed, what more appropriate place for his disciples to complete the circle, Plagueis told himself, than in profound obscurity, deep within an escarpment that walled an azure expanse of Baldemnik's northern sea. The two Sith were outfitted in environment suits that protected them from scorching heat and noxious atmosphere. The cave was cross-hatched by scores of enormous crystals that resembled glowing lances thrust every which way into a trick chest by a stage magician. A recent seismic event had tipped the landmass, emptying the labyrinthine cave system of mineral-rich waters. But the magma chamber that had kept the waters simmering for millions of years still heated the humid air to temperatures in excess of what even Tenebris and Plagueis could endure unaided. Close at hand sat a stubby treadroid tasked with monitoring the progress of a mining probe that was sampling a rich vein of Cortosis ore at the bottom of a deep shaft. A fabled ore, some called it, owing to its scarcity, but even more for its intrinsic ability to diminish the effectiveness of the Jedi lightsaber. For that reason, the Jedi Order had gone to great lengths to restrict mining and refinement of the ore. If not the bane of the Order's existence, Cortosis was a kind of irritant, a challenge to their weapon's reputation for fearsome invincibility. It was to Tenebris's credit that the Sith had learned of Baldemnik's rich lodes before the Jedi, who by means of an agreement with the Republic Senate had first claim to all discoveries, as they had with the Deegan crystals and force-sensitive younglings of all species. But Tenebris and the generations of Sith masters who had preceded him were privy to covert data gleaned by vast networks of informants the Senate and the Jedi knew nothing about, including mining survey teams and weapons manufacturers.
"Based on the data I am receiving," the treadroid intoned, 82% of the ore is capable of being purified into weapons-grade Cortosis shield."
Plagueis looked at Tenebris, who returned a nod of satisfaction.
"The percentage is consistent with what I was told to expect."
"By whom, Master?"
"Of no consequence,"
Tenebris said. Strewn about the superheated tunnel were broken borer bits, expended gasifiers, and clogged filtration masks, all abandoned by the exploratory team that had sunk the shaft several standard months earlier. From the shaft's broad mouth issued the repeated reports of the probe droid's hydraulic jacks, music to Tenebris's auditory organs, Plagueis was certain.
Can you not share your plans for this discovery?
In due time, Darth Plagueis.
Tenebris turned away from him to address the tread droid.
Instruct the probe to evaluate the properties of the secondary load.
Plagueis studied the screen affixed to the droid's flat head. It displayed a map of the probe's movements and a graphic analysis of its penetrating scans, which reached clear to the upper limits of the magma chamber.
The probe is running an analysis,
the treadroid updated. With the reciprocating sounds of the probe's hydraulic jacks echoing in the crystal cave, Tenebris began to circle the shaft, only to come to a sudden halt when the drilling ceased.
Why has it stopped?
He asked before Plagueis could. The droid's reply was immediate.
The M2 unit informs me that it has discovered a pocket of gas directly beneath the new borehole.
The droid paused, then added,
I'm sorry to report, sirs, that the gas is a highly combustible variant of lephane. The M2 unit predicts that the heat generated by its hydraulic jacks will ignite an explosion of significant magnitude.
Suspicion crept into Tanipris's voice.
The original report made no mention of lephane.
The droid pivoted to face him.
I know nothing of that, sir, but the M2 unit is quite insistent. What's more, my own programming corroborates the fact that it is not unusual to find pockets of lephane in close proximity to Cortosis ore.
Query the probe about excavating around the lephane pocket, Plagueis said.
The M2 unit recommends employing that very strategy, sir. Shall I order it to proceed?
Plagueis looked at Tenebris, who nodded.
Task the probe to proceed, Plagueis said.
When the hammering recommenced, he fixed his gaze on the display screen to monitor the probe's progress.
Tell the probe to stop,
he said after only a moment had elapsed.
Why are you interfering?
Tenebris said, storming forward. Plagueis gestured to the display.
The map indicates a more massive concentration of lephane in the area where it's drilling.
You're correct, sir,
the droid said in what amounted to dismay.
I will order the unit to halt all activity.
And yet the hammering continued.
Droid,
Plagueis snapped.
Did the probe acknowledge your order?
No, sir. The M2 is not responding.
Tenebris stiffened, narrowly avoiding slamming his head into one of the cave's massive crystals.
Is it still within range?
Yes, sir.
Then run a communications diagnostic.
I have, sir, and all systems are nominal. The unit's inability to respond...
It fell briefly silent and began again.
The unit's refusal to respond appears to be deliberate.
Deactivate it,
Tenebris said.
At once.
The hammering slowed and eventually ceased, but not for long.
The M2 unit has overridden my command.
Impossible, Tenebris said.
Clearly not, sir. In fact, it is highly probable that the unit is executing a deep-seated subroutine that escaped earlier notice.
Plagueis glanced at Tenebris.
Who procured the probe? This isn't the time for questions. The probe is about to breach the pocket.
Hastening to the rim of the circular shaft, the two Sith removed their gloves and aimed their long-fingered, unprotected hands into the inky darkness. Instantly, tangles of blue electrical energy discharged from their fingertips, raining into the borehole. Strobing and clawing for the bottom, the vigorous bolts coruscated into the lateral corridor the probe had excavated. Crackling sounds spewed from the opening long after the Sith had harnessed their powers. Then the repetitive strikes of the jackhammer began once more.
It's the ore, Tenebris said. There's too much resistance here.
Plagueis knew what needed to be done.
I'll go down, he said,
and was on the verge of leaping into the shaft when Tenebris restrained him.
This can wait. We're returning to the grotto.
Plagueis hesitated, then nodded.
As you say, Master.
Tenebris swung to the droid.
Continue your attempts to deactivate the unit.
I will, sir. To do that, however, I will need to remain here.
What of it?
Tenebris said, cocking his head to one side.
Should I fail in my efforts, the ensuing explosion will surely result in my destruction.
Plagueis understood.
You've been useful, droid.
Thank you, sir.
Tenebris scowled.
You waste your breath.
Nearly knocked over by the swiftness of Tenebris' departure, Plagueis had to call deeply on the Force, merely to keep up. Retracing the inclined path they had taken from the grotto in which their starship waited, they fairly flew up the crystal-studded tunnel they had picked their way through earlier. Plagueis grasped that a powerful explosion was perhaps imminent, but was mystified by his master's almost mad dash for the surface. In the past, Tenebris had rarely evinced signs of discomfort, let alone fear. So what danger had he sensed that propelled him with such abandon? And when, in the past, had they fled danger of any sort? Safeguarded by the powers of the dark side, the Sith could hardly fear death when they were allied to it. Plagueis stretched out with his feelings in an attempt to identify the source of Tenebris' dread, but the Force was silent. 10 meters ahead of him, the Bith had ducked under a scabrous outcropping. Haste, however, brought him upright too quickly, and his left shoulder glanced off the rough rock, leaving a portion of his suit shredded.
"Master, allow me to lead,"
Plagueis said when he reached Tenebris. He was only slightly more agile than the Bith, but he had better night vision and a keener sense of direction over and above what the Force imparted. His pride, wounded more than his shoulder, Tenebris waved off the offer.
"Be mindful of your place."
Regaining his balance and composure, he streaked off. But at a fork in the tunnel, he took the wrong turn.
"This way, Master,"
Plagueis called from the other corridor. But he stopped to surrender the lead. Closer to the surface, the tunnels opened into cabins the size of cathedrals, smoothed and hollowed by rainwater that still surged in certain seasons of Baldemnik's long year. In pools of standing water darted various species of blind fish. Overhead, hawk bats took panicked flight from their roosting places in the stippled ceiling. Natural light in the far distance prompted the two Sith to race for the grotto, but even so, they were a moment late. The gas explosion caught up with them just as they were entering the light-filled cavity at the top of the escarpment. From deep in the tunnel resounded a squealing electronic wail, and at the same time, almost as if the cave system were gasping for breath, a searing wind tore down from a perforation in the grotto's arched ceiling through which the ship had entered. A muffled but ground-heaving detonation followed, then a roiling fireball that was the labyrinth's scorching exhalation. Whirling to the tunnel they had just exited and managing somehow to remain on his feet, Tenebris conjured a force shield with his waving arms that met the fireball and contained it. Thousands of flaming hawkbats spiraling within the tumult like wind-blown embers. A few meters away, Plagueis, hurled face-first to the ground by the intensity of the vaporizing blast, lifted his head in time to see the underside of the domed ceiling begin to shed enormous slabs of rock. Directly below the plummeting slabs sat their starship.
"Master,"
he said, scrambling to his feet with arms lifted in an attempt to hold the rocks in midair. His own arms still raised in a force-summoning posture, Tenebris swung around to bolster Plagueis' intent. Behind him, the fireball's final flame surged from the mouth of the tunnel to lick his back and drive him deeper into the grotto. The cave continued to spasm underfoot, sending shock waves through the crazed ceiling. Cracks spread like a web from the oculus, triggering collapses throughout the grotto. Plagueis heard a rending sound overhead and watched a fissure zigzag its way across the ceiling, sloughing layer after layer of stone as it followed the grotto's curved wall. Now, though, it was Tenebris who was positioned beneath the fall. And in that instant, Plagueis perceived the danger Tenebris had foreseen earlier. His death. His death at Plagueis' hands. While Tenebris was preoccupied holding the slabs that threatened to crush the ship, Plagueis quickly reoriented himself, aiming his raised hands at the plummeting slabs above his master, and with a downward motion of both arms, brought them down so quickly and with so much momentum that Tenebris was buried almost before he understood what had hit him. Stone dust eddying around him, Plagueis stood rooted in place as slabs interred the starship as well. But he gave it no thought. His success in bringing the ceiling down on Tenebris was proof enough that the Bith had grown sluggish and expendable. Otherwise, he would have divined the true source of the danger he had sensed,
and Plagueis would be the one pressed to the floor of the grotto, head cracked open like an egg, and chest cavity pierced by the pointed end of a fallen stalactite. His race to Tenebris's side was informed as much by excitement as charade.
"Master," he said,
genuflecting and removing his and Tenebris's respirators. His hands pawed at the stones, removing some of the crushing weight. But Tenebris's single lung was pierced, and blood gurgled in his throat. Ragged tears in the sleeves of the environment suit revealed esoteric body markings and tattoos.
"Stop, apprentice," Tenebris strained to say. "You're going to need all your strength."
"I can bring help. There's time."
"I'm dying, Darth Plagueis. There's time only for that."
Plagueis held the Bith's pained gaze. "I did all that I could, Master." Tenebris interrupted him once more.
"To be strong in the Force is one thing, but to believe oneself to be all-powerful is to invite catastrophe. Remember that even in the ethereal realm we inhabit, the unforeseen can occur."
A stuttering cough silenced him for a moment.
"Better this way, perhaps, than to perish at your hand."
As Darth Bane would have wished, Plagueis thought. "Who supplied the mining probe, Master?"
"Subtext," Tenebris said in a weak voice. "Subtext mining."
Plagueis nodded. "I will avenge you." Tenebris canted his huge head ever so slightly.
"Will you?"
"Of course." If the Bith was convinced, he kept it to himself and said instead,
"You are fated to bring the Sith imperative to fruition, Plagueis. It falls to you to bring the Jedi Order to its knees and to save the rest of the galaxy's sentience from themselves."
At long last, Plagueis told himself, the mantle is conferred.
"But I need to warn you,"
Tenebris started to say and fell abruptly silent. Plagueis could sense the Bith's highly evolved mind replaying recent events, calculating odds, reaching conclusions.
"Warn me about what, Master?"
Tenebris's black eyes shone with yellow light, and his free hand clutched at the ring collar of Plagueis's enviro suit.
"You?"
Plagueis pried the Bith's thin hand from the fabric and grinned faintly.
"Yes, Master. Your death comes at my bidding. You said yourself that perpetuation with purpose is the way to victory, and so it is. Go to your grave knowing that you are last of the old order, the vaunted rule of two, and that the new order begins now, and will for 1,000 years remain in my control."
Tenebris coughed spittle and blood.
"Then for the last time, I call you, apprentice, and I applaud your skillful use of surprise and misdirection. Perhaps I was wrong to think you had no stomach for it."
"The dark side guided me, Tenebris. You sensed it, but your lack of faith in me clouded your thoughts." The Bith's head bobbed in agreement.
"Even before we came to Baldemnik."
"And yet we came."
"Because we were fated to."
Tenebris paused, then spoke with renewed urgency.
"But wait! The ship!"
"Crushed, as you are." Tenebris's anger stabbed at Plagueis.
"You've risked everything to undo me. The entire future of the Sith. My instincts about you prove correct after all."
Plagueis leaned away from him, nonchalant, but in fact filled with an icy fury.
"I'll find a way home, Tenebris. As will you."
And with a chopping motion of his left hand, he broke the Bith's neck. Tenebris was paralyzed and unconscious, but not yet dead. Plagueis had no interest in saving him, even if it were possible. But he was interested in observing the behavior of the Bith's midichlorians as life ebbed. The Jedi thought of the cellular organelles as symbionts. But to Plagueis, midichlorians were interlopers, running interference for the Force, and standing in the way of a being's ability to contact the Force directly. Through years of experimentation and directed meditation, Plagueis had honed an ability to perceive the actions of midichlorians, though not yet the ability to manipulate them. Manipulate them, say, to prolong Tenebris' life. Looking at the Bith through the Force, he perceived that the midichlorians were already beginning to die out, as were the neurons that made up Tenebris' lofty brain and the muscle cells that powered his once-able heart. A common misconception held that midichlorians were Force-carrying particles, when in fact they functioned more as translators, interlocutors of the will of the Force. Plagueis considered his long-standing fascination with the organelles to be as natural as had been Tenebris' fixation on shaping the future. Where Bith intelligence was grounded in mathematics and computation, Mune intelligence was driven by a will to profit. As a Mune, Plagueis viewed his allegiance to the Force as an investment that could, with proper effort, be maximized to yield great returns. True, too, to Mune psychology and tradition, he had through the decades hoarded his successes and never once taken Tenebris into his confidence. The Bith's moribund midichlorians were winking out, like lights slowly deprived of a power source. And yet Plagueis could still perceive Tenebris in the Force. One day, he would succeed in imposing his will on the midichlorians to keep them aggregate. But such speculations were for another time. Just now, Tenebris and all he had been in life were beyond Plagueis' reach. He wondered if the Jedi were subsumed in similar fashion. Even in life, did midichlorians behave in a Jedi as they did in a devotee of the dark side? Were the organelles invigorated by different impulses, prompted into action by different desires? He had encountered many Jedi during his long life, but he had never made an attempt to study one in the same way he appraised Tenebris now, out of concern for revealing the power of his alliance with the dark side. That, too, might have to change. Tenebris died while Plagueis observed. In Bane's age, a Sith might have had to guard against an attempt at essence transfer by the deceased, a leap into the consciousness of the Sith who survived. But those times were long past and of no relevance. Not since the teachings had been sabotaged, the technique lost. The last Sith possessed of the knowledge had been inexplicably drawn to the light side and killed, taking the secret process with him. Chapter 2. The Inner Landscape. Plagueis wasn't certain how long he remained at Tenebris' side. Long enough, though, that when he rose, his legs were quivering, and some of the dust from the explosion had settled. Only when he took a few backward steps did he realize that the event had not left him unscathed. At some point, probably when he was focused on murder, a rock or some other projectile had pulped a large area of his lower back. And now the thin tunic he wore beneath the envirosuit was saturated with blood. Despite the swirling dust, he inhaled deeply, eliciting a stab of pain from his ribcage and a cough that spewed blood into the hot air. Drawing on the Force, he numbed himself to the pain and tasked his body to limit the damage as best it could. When the injury ceased to preoccupy him, he surveyed the grotto, remaining anchored in place but turning a full circle. Littering the hard ground, injured hawkbats were chirping in distress and clawing through circles of their own. Far above him, a beam of oblique and dust-mooted daylight streamed through the dome's large oculus, itself the result of an earlier collapse. Close to the jumble of stones the collapse had piled on the grotto floor sat Tenebris' small but priceless starship, a Rugis gnome design. Alloy wings and snubbed nose poking from the artless mausoleum the explosion had fashioned. And finally, not meters away, lay Tenebris, similarly interred. Approaching the ship, Plagueis scanned the damage that had been inflicted on the deflector shield and navigation arrays, coolant ducts, sensors, and antennas. Tenebris would surely have been able to effect repairs to some of the components, but Plagueis was out of his depth, lacking not only Babith's fine motor skills, but his knowledge of the ship's systems. Though unique, a marvel of engineering, the ship couldn't be traced to Tenebris, since both the registry and title were counterfeit. It was possible that the rescue beacon was still functional, but Plagueis was reluctant to activate it. They had arrived on Baldemnik in stealth, and he intended to depart in like manner. But how? Again he squinted into the light pouring in through the oculus. Not even his power in the Force was enough to carry him from the floor and up through the grotto's unblinking eye. Nothing short of a jetpack would do, and the ship didn't carry one. His gaze drifted from the oculus to the grotto's curving walls. He supposed he could spider his way along the arched underside of the dome and reach the eye. But now he saw a better way. More, a way to accomplish two tasks at the same time. From a spot mid-distance between the ship and the rubble pile beneath the oculus, he immersed himself in the Force, and with gestures not unlike those he and Tenebris had used in arresting the ceiling collapse, began to levitate slabs from the ship and add them to the rubble heap, stopping only when he had both exposed the hatch of the ship and was confident he could force leap through the oculus from atop the augmented pile. When he tried springing the hatch, however, he found that it wouldn't budge. He was ultimately able to gain entry to the cockpit by assailing the transparasteel canopy with a series of Force blows. Worming his way inside, he retrieved his travel bag, which contained a comlink, his lightsaber, and a change of clothes, among other items. He also took Tenebris' comlink and lightsaber and made certain to erase the memory of the Navi computer. Once outside the ship, he peeled out of the enviro suit and blood-soaked tunic, trading them for dark trousers, an overshirt, lightweight boots, and a hooded robe. Affixing both lightsabers to his belt, he activated the comlink and called up a map of Baldemnik. With scant satellites in orbit, the planet had nothing in the way of a global positioning system, but the map told Plagueis all he needed to know about the immediate area. He took a final look around. It wasn't likely that an indigene would have reason to investigate the grotto, and it was even less likely that another interstellar visitor would find this place. Even so, he spent a moment regarding the scene objectively. A partially crushed but costly and salvage-worthy starship, the decomposed body of a Bith spacefarer, the aftermath of an explosive event, the scene of an unfortunate accident in a galaxy brimming with them. Satisfied, Plagueis leapt to the top of the pile, then through the roof into the remains of the day. The radiant heat of Baldemnik's primary beat down on his exposed skin, and a persistent offshore wind tugged at the robe. West and south, as far as his eyes could see, was an expanse of azure ocean, curling white where it pounded the coastline. Rugged, denuded hills vanished into sea mist. Plagueis imagined a time when forest had blanketed the landscape before the indigenous Khonmi had felled the trees for building materials and firewood. Now what vegetation survived was confined to the steep-sided gorges that separated the brown hills. A somber beauty. Perhaps, he thought, there was more to recommend the planet than deposits of Cortosis ore. A resident of Munalist for most of his adult life, Plagueis was no stranger to ocean worlds, but unlike most Munes, he was also accustomed to remote, low-tech ones, having spent his childhood and adolescence on a host of similar planets and moons. With that hemisphere of Baldemnik rotating quickly into night, the wind was increasing in strength and the temperature was dropping. The map he had called up on the comlink showed that the planet's primary spaceport was only a few hundred kilometers to the south. Tenebris had intentionally skirted the port when they had made planetfall, coming in over the northern ice cap rather than over the sea. Plagueis calculated that he could cover the distance to the spaceport by evening of the following day, which would still give him a standard week in which to return to Munalinst in time to host the gathering on Sojourn. But he knew, too, that the route would take him through areas inhabited by both elite and plebeian Khonmi. So he resolved to travel at night to avoid contact with the noisome and xenophobic reptilian sapients. There was little point to leaving dead bodies in his wake. Cinching the robe around his waist, he began to move, slowly at first, then gathering speed, until to any being watching he would have appeared a dazzling blur, an errant dust devil racing across the treeless terrain. He hadn't run far before he chanced upon a rudimentary trail impressed in places with the footprints of Indigenes, and he paused to study them. Barefoot lower-class Kon Mi had left the prints, probably fisherfolk, whose thatched roof dwellings dotted the shoreline. Plagueis reckoned the size and weight of the reptilians responsible for the tracks, and estimated the time elapsed since they had passed. Drawing himself up, he scanned the dun hills, then sniffed the wind, wishing he were imbued with even a touch of Tenebris's olfactory acuity. Up ahead, he was bound to encounter elite Kon Mi as well, or at the very least their cliffside dome dwellings. Night fell as he resumed his pace. The ocean shone silver under starlight, and night-blooming flora scented the humid air with heady aromas. Predators of any size had been hunted to extinction on the northern island continents, but the deep gorges were home to countless varieties of voracious insects that set upon him in clouds as he picked his way through the dense underbrush. Lowering his body temperature and slowing his breathing to alter the mixture of gases in his exhalations did little to dissuade the insects, so after a while he ceased all attempts at warding them off and surrendered to their thirst for blood, which they drew freely from his face, neck, and hands. "Let them devour the old Plagueis," he thought. In the dark wood of that remote world, with a salted wind whistling through the trees and a distant sound of waves like drumming, he would take flight from the underworld in which the Sith had dwelled. Awakened from a millennium of purposeful sleep, the power of the dark side would be reborn, and he, Plagueis, would carry the long-forged plan to completion. Through the night he ran, sheltering inside a shallow cave while the morning mist was evanescing from the hollows. Even that early, the blue-scaled Indigenes were about, appearing from their huts to cast nets into the crashing surf, or paddle boats to stretches of reef or nearby islets. The best of their catch would be carried into the hills to stuff the bellies of the wealthy, with whom rested responsibility for Baldemnik's political and economic future. Their guttural voices stole into the cave that fit Plagueis like a tomb, and he could understand some of the words they exchanged. He chased sleep, but it eluded him, and he deplored the fact that he still had need for it. Tenebris had never slept, but then Fubith did. Awake in the oppressive heat, he replayed the events of the previous day, still somewhat astounded by what he had done. The Force had whispered to him, "Your moment has come. Claim your stake to the dark side. Act now, and be done with this." But the Force had only advised. It had neither dictated his actions nor guided his hands. That had been his doing alone. He knew from his travels with and without Tenebris that he wasn't the galaxy's sole practitioner of the dark side, nor Sith for that matter, since the galaxy was rife with pretenders. But he was now the only Sith Lord descended from the Bane line. A true Sith, and that realization roused the raw power coiled inside him. And yet, when he reached out with the Force, he could detect the presence of something or some being of near equal power. Was it the dark side itself, or merely a vestige of his uncertainty? He had read the legends of Bane, how he had been hounded by the lingering presences of those he had defeated in order to rid the Sith Order of infighting, and return the Order to a genuine hegemony by instating the rule of two, a master to embody power, an apprentice to crave it. To hear it told, Bane had even been hounded by the spirits of generations dead Sith lords whose tombs and manses he had desecrated in his fervent search for holocrons and other ancient devices offering wisdom and guidance. Was Tenebris's spirit the source of the power he sensed? Was there a brief period of survival after death, during which a true Sith could continue to influence the world of the living? It was as if the mass of the galaxy had descended on him. A lesser being might have heaved his shoulders, but Plagueis wedged into his clandestine tomb, felt as weightless as he would have in deep space. He would outlive any who challenged him. Hours later, when the voices had faded and the insect's feeding frenzy had started anew, pain roused Plagueis from tortured slumber. The tunic was adhered to his swollen flesh like a pressure bandage, but blood had seeped from the wound and soaked through to the robe. Slipping silently into the night, he limped until he had suppressed the pain, then began to run, beads of perspiration evaporating from his hairless head, and the dark robe unfurling behind him like a banner. Famished, he considered raiding one of the local homes and feasting on the eggs of some low-caste conmi, or perhaps on the blood of her and her mate. But he reined in his impulses to strike terror, his appetite for destruction, sating himself instead on bats and the rotting remains of fish the waves had washed ashore. Hurrying along the black sand beach, he passed within meters of dwellings built from blocks of fossilized reef stone, but he glimpsed only one indigene, who, on leaving his hut naked to relieve himself, reacted as if he had seen an apparition, or else in hilarity at the figure Plagueis must have cut in robe and boots. On the cliffs high above the beach, artificial lights glimmered, announcing the homes of the elite and the proximity of the spaceport, whose ambient glow illuminated a broad area of the southern littoral. His destination close at hand, each incoming ocean wave reverberated inside him, summoning an unprecedented tide of dark energy. The knotted tendrils of time loosened, and he had a glimpse into Baldemnik's future. Embroiled in a multi-fronted war, a galactic war, in part because of its rich deposits of cortosis, but more as a pawn in a convoluted game, the subservient Konmi turned against those who had mastered them for eons. Lost in reverie, Plagueis almost failed to notice that a massive breakwater now followed the curve of the beach. Stone jetties jutted into a broad, calm bay, and behind the wall, a city climbed into a surround of deforested foothills. Konmi of both classes were about, but interspersed among them were off-worlders of many species, most from neighboring star systems, but some from as distant as the core. The spaceport formed the city's southernmost outskirts, made up of clusters of modular buildings, prefabricated warehouses and hangars, illuminated landing areas for cargo and passenger ships. To a being unfamiliar with isolated worlds, a tour through the spaceport would have seemed closer to time travel, but Plagueis felt at home among the cubicle hotels, dimly lighted tap cafes, and squalid cantinas where entertainment was costly and life was cheap. Raising the cowl of the robe over his head, he kept to the shadows, his height alone enough to draw attention. With security lax, he was able to circulate among the grounded vessels without difficulty. He ignored the smaller inter-system ships in favor of long-haul freighters, and even then, only those that appeared to be in good condition. Munamensk was several hyperspace jumps distant, and only a ship with adequate jump capability could deliver him there without too much delay. After an hour of searching, he found one to his liking. A product of core engineering, the freighter had to be a half a century old, but it had been well maintained and retrofitted with modern sensor suites and subspace drives. That it bore no legend suggested that the ship's captain wasn't interested in having the ship make a name for itself. Longer than it was wide, LS-4473 had a narrow fantail, an undermount cockpit, and broad cargo bay doors which permitted it to take on large freight. With the registry numbers stored in his comlink, Plagueis angled his way to the Spaceport Authority building. At that time of night, the dilapidated structure was all but deserted, save for two thick-necked Konmi guards who were sleeping on duty. Loosening the robe's sash to provide ready access to his lightsabers, Plagueis eased past them and disappeared through the main doors. Faint light from unoccupied offices spilled into the dark hallways. On the second floor, he found the registrar's office, which overlooked the largest of the landing zones and the silent bay beyond.
A comp that had been an antique 20 years earlier sat atop a desk in a smaller private office. Plagueis placed his comlink alongside the machine, and an instant later had sliced into the spaceport control network. A search for the freighter revealed that it did indeed go by a name. The Wobegon, out of Ord Mantell. Scheduled to launch the following morning, the ship, with her crew of 8, including one droid, was bound for several worlds in the Aurel sector, carrying cargoes of fresh sea life. According to the manifest, the cargo had already cleared customs and was housed in a refrigerated hangar awaiting transfer to the ship. The good news was that the Wobegon's ultimate destination was Ithor, on the far side of the Hydean Way. A side trip to Munalinst, therefore, might not strike the crew as too great a detour. Plagueis called up an image of the freighter's captain, whose name was given as Elan La. Opening himself fully to the Force, he studied the image for a long moment. Then, exhaling slowly, he stood, erased all evidence of his technological intrusions, and returned the comlink to his robe's inner pocket. The Wobegon had been waiting for him. Chapter 3. Wobegon. Plagueis' instincts about Baldemnik were correct. The planet's rugged beauty was of a sort that appealed to the hedonistic side of human nature, and would one day draw the wealthiest of that species to bask in the warm light of its primary, tow its pristine sands, swim in its animated waters, and dine on the toothsome fish that filled its vast oceans. But in those days, humans were still relatively scarce in that part of the Outer Rim, and most visitors to Baldemnik hailed from hut space or the far reaches of the Perlemian trade route. And so Captain Elan La was Togruta, and her first mate, a Zabrak named Makap. The Wobegon's pilot was a Balasar, her navigator, a Dresselian, and her 3 crew members, Klatuinian, Kalish, and an Aqualish of the Quara race. Near humans all, to use the term favored at that time in the Corps, where chauvinism had been raised to an art form. The only non-sentient was a bipedal multi-appendaged droid called 114D, after its model number. Baldemnik was but one of their planetary haunts. As often as not, they could be spotted on Vestral, Sikkim 4, or Carlix's Folly. But all were similar, in that Captain Law and her shipmates rarely saw anything more of the planets than what lay within a radius of 5 kilometers from the principal spaceports, and their contact with indigenes was limited to spaceport functionaries, merchants, information brokers, and those in the pleasure professions. Theirs was a precarious business, at a time when pirates plied the intersystem trade routes, hyperspace beacons were few and far between, and a lapse in judgment could result in disaster. The cost of fuel was exorbitant. Corrupt customs officials had to be bribed, and import-export taxes were subject to change without notice. Delays meant that cargoes of foodstuffs could lose the freshness that made them desirable, or worse yet, spoil altogether. Dangers were manifold, and the earnings were meager. You had to love the work, or perhaps be on the run, from the law, yourself, or whoever else. As a consequence of having imbibed too much local grog and gambled away too many hard-earned credits, and perhaps as atonement for so much carousing, concerns about the coming trip had bobbed to the surface of Captain La's mind like an inflated balloon held underwater, then released. "No oversights this run," she was warning the crew in a gentle way, as they made their way across the landing zone to their waiting ship. The fact that she had used the same euphemism Bleer had to minimize the impact of the near catastrophe he had caused made all of them laugh, except the Balasar, who lowered his head in mock shame, his twin antenna palps deepening in color.
"We take your meaning, Captain," Makap said. "No inopportune omissions." "Ineradicable errors," the Kalish Pepe Roche interjected.
"Dumbass mistakes," Duzuto completed, his close-set inward-curving tusks in need of a thorough scaling.
The captain allowed them a moment of merriment. "I'm serious," she said as they approached the Wobegon's lowered boarding ramp.
"I'll say it again. This ship operates as a democracy. I'm your captain because knowing who's good at what is just something I have a talent for.
She looked at Bleer.
Do I ever tell you how to pilot?
Then at Simisali.
Do I ever question your decision about jump points?
No, Captain, the two said, as if by rote.
So I'm simply speaking as a member of what should be a competent team and not as a commander.
She blew out her breath in a way that shook her trio of striped headtails.
Either we turn a profit on this run, or we think about going to the huts for another loan.
Even Wandao, who had more dealings with various huts than anyone else, bemoaned the mere prospect.
That's right, La told the tall Clatuinian. And don't any of you fool yourself into thinking that we can float an honest loan, because no bank worth its assets is going to accept the Wobegon as collateral.
Markop and Bleer traded quick glances before the Zabrok said,
Excuse me for saying so, Captain, but you didn't seem particularly concerned about credits last night.
Watch what you say,
La told her first mate, barely restraining a smile.
I thought you were ready to give that young thing the ship,
Pepe said, joining the tease.
La waved a hand in dismissal. I was just toying with him.
Toy being the operative word,
Markop said,
since he was young enough to still play with them.
The captain planted her hands on her hips.
I can be convincing when I want to be.
Oh, that you were, Zuto said,
reigniting a chorus of laughter that accompanied them into the Wobegon's main cabin space, where 114D was waiting.
Everything in order?
La asked the droid. The droid raised three of its appendages in an approximation of a salute.
Shipshape, Captain.
All the cargo is aboard and accounted for.
Aboard and accounted for, Captain.
You check the thermal readouts?
In each bay, Captain.
She returned a satisfied nod.
Well, all right then.
The shipmates split up, each with duties to perform. Bleer and Simisali to the cockpit. Zuto, Wandao, and Pepe to check that the cargo had been properly stowed. Markop and 114D to seal the ship. And Captain La to get clearance from Baldemnik Spaceport Control. Without fanfare, the ship left the warm world behind and jumped from cold ether into the netherworld of hyperspace. La was still seated at the communications console when Bleer radioed her from the cockpit.
We need your input on something.
Since when, she said.
Seriously.
She headed forward and had no sooner ducked into the cockpit than Simisali indicated a flashing telltale on the ship's status display suite. A small metal plate below the telltale read, Cargo Bay 4 Ambient.
Too hot or too cold?
La asked the Dresselian.
Too cold.
La flicked her forefinger against the telltale, but it continued to flash.
Funny, that usually works.
She studied Simisali's frown.
What do you think?
He sniffed and ran a hand over a hairless, deeply fissured head that mirrored the appearance of the convoluted brain it contained.
Well, it could be the bay thermostat.
Or?
Or one of the shipping containers could have opened.
By itself?
Maybe during the jump,
Bleer said from the pilot's chair.
Okay, so we go check it out.
She glanced from Bleer to Simisali and shook her head in ignorance.
What aren't you telling me?
Bleer answered for the two of them.
Remember the Zabrok that Ma was talking to in the cantina?
Which cantina?
La said, then added, No, I remember him. He was looking for a lift. Simisali nodded.
He had been booted from his last freighter. He didn't say why. But Ma thought he smelled trouble and said we couldn't take him aboard.
La followed the clues they were giving her and nodded.
You're thinking we have a stowaway. Just a thought, the Dresselian said. Which is why you wanted to check with me before going aft.
Exactly.
La's face grew almost as wrinkled as Simisali's.
The ship would have told us if anyone had tampered with the anti-intrusion, sis.
Unless he came in with a cargo,
Bleer said.
You mean inside one of the containers?
Bleer nodded.
Well, then he'd be stiff as an icicle by now.
La turned to Simisali.
Does Bay 4 have a vid feed?
On screen,
Simisali said, swiveling his chair to face the status displays. La put her palms flat on the console and leaned toward the screen while the Dresselian brought up grainy views of the cargo bay. Finally, the remote cam found what they were looking for. An open shipping container, wreathed by clouds of coolant, with its cargo of costly meat fins already defrosting. Spawn of a... Lars started when the next view of the cargo bay stunned her into slack-jawed silence. Blear blinked repeatedly before asking,
Is that what I think it is?